Folks, we're leaving Zans in 2017.
Thank you.
No, it's so funny watching the conservative freak out over the response to Kevin Williamson being hired by The Atlantic and all of them saying, my God, the brightest conservative voices of our generation, the liberal no platformers are going to go after to ensure that they have nowhere they can write for.
Like, the everyone who is like politically active when they were like 16 had a phase where they read The Atlantic and read like, you know, the brave new age of IQ vote testing by Andrew Sullivan or whatever. And it's like, no, this is like exactly as shitty as The Atlantic is. But it is funny that everyone is pretending that Kevin D. Williamson should have any job except being the host of a sort of medieval time spinoff where it's Dracula's castle.
Yeah.
And he gives you a big chicken leg.
Yeah. It's really there's a double edged sword with criticizing something like a Williamson hire by The Atlantic, because on the one hand, you want to point out, this is horrifying. Why are you platforming this maniac, this drooling Bond villain who wants to bring back Hoovervilles and forced abortion and, you know, forced childbirth at gunpoint? What does that say about the range of opinion? You know, there's no left comparable voice you could have on that would equal Kevin Williamson on the right, and it's unfair. And that's one true point, but it misses a larger point, which is the fucking Atlantic Monthly is neoliberal dabiq. It is like a fundamentalist psychotic rag devoted single-mindedly to this death ideology. And everything is going to serve that end, from Tennessee Coates' stuff about race to Williamson to fucking Connor Frozendorf talking about fucking free speech and space spaces to fucking Sullivan showing up every once in a while to bust out the fucking calipers for race science. They all serve the same agenda. And that means that the idea of a Atlantic that was truly balanced is meaningless, because that's not what the function of that media organ is.
Well, yeah, that's it. I don't really care about the sanctity of The Atlantic's editorial stance or whether or not Williamson can disseminate his ideas. I just think personally that Kevin Williamson should be destitute in a just society. He should have no property and no job whatsoever. So we're in San Francisco right now. It's our last day here. And just earlier, I was walking down the street and a bearded man sitting on a stoop started yelling at me about Pol Pot. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, we're going the way of the Khmer Rouge and soon there's going to be piles of skulls. And I thought to myself, okay, this guy should, in a just world, trade places with Kevin D. Williamson. And it should be him writing for The Atlantic and Williamson sitting on a stoop in Haight-Ashbury yelling and begging strangers to listen to his crank ideas.
Yes, absolutely.
All of these fucking bullshit publications are like, oh, we need ideological diversity, so we need to hire every single anti-Trump Republican in America. And they're close because they're inching up on like 100.
Yeah.
And all the big, and that's about as many as there are in America. But like, if you really wanted like ideological diversity that represented America, you would get like a bodybuilder who lives in his car. You would get Mike Cernovich.
Bob
Avakian. You get a black Israelite. These are all more interesting.
Yeah.
Oh,
these
absolutely.
Are way more interesting.
No
the
question.
only places that you can shake things up are gender and fucking race science. Those are the only taboos you can't break.
Yeah.
Everything else is fair game.
Now, I think my ideal political publication that does have a wide spectrum of political ideas would be run like those phony homeopathic science journals where they just accept everything.
Yeah, there should be no op-ed page. There shouldn't be op-ed writers.
No, the idea is ridiculous.
But the idea of a revolving Vox Populi where random citizens write a fucking op-ed every week for the New York Times, that would be worthwhile.
Oh, that would
like,
be great.
Like the Sweden Twitter account.
Yes.
But like they did that thing with Trump voters who were all like, you know, I'm sick of these rich liberals looking down on me. I only own a 30-store jet ski chain. I only have 7 houses. I'm just doing some down-home racism. I'm the forgotten man. But if he was really representative, you'd have like a guy who thinks gun kata from Equilibrium is real. It would like barely be political, except everything is political now, because then there would be like an article in one of those sites that sort of looks like Kotaku in 2014, where it's like, you know, how the hidden problematic nature of Equilibrium gun kata. You know, how come Taye Diggs was the villain?
So I was sick all day yesterday. I was still under the weather. Probably
sick of these jokers, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I probably contracted something from shaking hands with all the fans after the show. All the urchins.
Sacrifices are astounding.
Wow.
Oh, it might be a germ warfare type thing. Haven't ruled that out yet. Antifa involvement, HARP. Mm-hmm.
Adam Waffen.
They saw you during doing journalism.
So I just kind of spent the day in bed, kind of feverish, and just continuing to boil up my brain by reading these responses on Twitter. I found two great ones. First off, from Toilet Paper Carney.
No, that guy, he deleted his, unfortunately.
They always pretend there's an acceptable conservative somewhere. Oh, just not do that. Just not McArdle. Anyone but Stevens. Williamson is literally the worst they could have picked. Murray, Shapiro, etc., etc. The point is to inflict maximum pain and to make the talented be afraid to stick their necks out.
Wow, he just named a Mount Rushmore of talent.
I need to tap on the mic here.
Oh, the biggest lie about all this Kevin D. Williamson controversy is that he's a talented writer.
Yeah.
The idea that he's an excellent prose stylist. Fucking Ta-Nehisi Coates yes. said, "Hey man, if you can write, I'll read anybody."
Yeah.
I mean,
Go fucking draw another cartoon. Jesus Christ.
Try to read any Kevin D. Williamson. We did at the LA live show, by the way. The guy is just a pretentious hack aping Bill Buckley, like, but Xeroxed a million times over. So it's like one of those memes with Shaq where his eyes are red.
I've read enough Megan McArdle to last a lifetime. And that woman is a golden retriever, as you, the audience, would know. By the way, this is Will Menaker, who is currently in the kitchen right by this room making din-din. How's it going, Will?
Okay, the bolognese is coming along real strong. I got all my aromatics properly sautéed and sweated with a little pancetta.
Whoa.
I just added them to the big brown meat pot.
Amaron.
It's about to all start coming together.
Oh,
now we're cooking.
Oh, yeah. Take that, Megan McArdle. We're outside of the Northeast, and yet we're eating delicious Italian food. Make sense of that with your science.
And the other one I flagged that I just found so funny, I don't even really get the context of this, but it was a friend of the show, Baseball Crank, talking to other friend of the show, Sarah Jones.
Oh, the Baseball Crank has something to say.
Baseball Crank, I can't do the
voice. Do the voice.
Let's go back to your baseline premise that you think it desirable for the law to allow killing people like Kevin Williamson in the womb.
That is... I'm imagining Kevin D. Williamson in utero, already wearing a cape and a beard.
Kevin Williamson
and
was
they're like, oh, I can hear his mom is feeling it. They're like, oh, I can feel him playing the organ in there.
Kev was the baby on the Nirvana cover.
Sorry, one more comment about Kev Man. Again, the idea, the big controversy, the one thing that most people are latching onto is his open statement that women who get an abortion should be hung, should be executed for the crime of murder. Now, I happen to sort of think that, like, at least he has the balls to just go that far. As we tried to, when we pressed Walther on this issue, he clammed up, as almost all pro-life people do, because they understand it's the one step you cannot make and still be considered a human being in our society, right? And so the line is that, like, look, he's pro-life. They're trying to say, is it completely beyond the bounds to be pro-life? The answer is, well, kind of yes. But beyond that, what he's advocating is... probably the execution of maybe 30% of all adult women in our society.
Yep.
So
statistically, women in his newsroom.
And fucking Goldberg's attitude about this is like, oh, well, you know, I believe he can grow and do better. And I think he just is an important voice to have.
He's a lively voice. Yeah. He's a lively dissenting voice. Hey, buddy, how about you hire somebody on your master who thinks that Israel should be wiped off the map?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. Oh, dude, hire the Japanese candidate who wore Under Armour and a kimono and said, the Jew fears the samurai. Hire that dude.
I think everyone who had a hand in planning and carrying out the Iraq war... including Jeffrey Goldberg,
should be dropped out of the helicopter.
Should be executed as well.
Yes.
Hire me to the Atlantic.
There should be Fortnite for Iraq war boots.
You know the trampoline in Fortnite, right?
Yeah.
Well, Kev's at a disadvantage because it would not work with him.
Well, the nice thing is, like, sometimes in Fortnite you see another player's reflection in the water.
You can figure out they're there. Not a problem with Kev.
Yeah. No reflections at all.
Stealth advantage.
Yeah, his real problem is when the sun comes back out.
What do you say?
Should we get it going?
Start the show.
Chapo, let's go.
Chapo, is that what he says?
That's what he says.
All right, okay.
Oh, man.
Chapo, let's go.
Not giving me confidence.
Chapo, let's go.
Chapo, let's go.
Chapo, let's go.
Chapo, let's go.
Chapo, let's go. Hello, everyone. It's your Chapo for this week. I'm Virgil, Texas. Joining me, as always, Felix Biederman, Matt Chrisman, and Will Menaker in the kitchen, who's going to pop in with some culinary information.
He's cooking up a storm in there.
Do we need any liquor, by the way? Because I'm ordering cigarettes. And
sure.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey, Will, don't put too much onions in the sauce.
And again, we are still in San Francisco in the middle of our West Coast tour, having done two wonderful shows earlier this week at the Victoria.
Yes, fantastic shows, fantastic crowd. We've been totally beguiled by this jewel on the bay. It really does feel like we're in that Ray Bradbury story where the people show up on the perfect village and it's all so wonderful, and then they realize that, oh, they're all Martians and they're going to kill us. Because we all know that there's some twist, there's some catch, but on first inspection, it's absolutely enchanting.
And by the way, you are absolutely mandated to enjoy this episode, because if we hear one word of negativity about it, we are giving you 7 live shows in a row.
Yes, only those. No other content. We're taking a fucking vacation.
Joining us as our San Francisco guest today is Shanti Singh, who works at Tenants Together and is the co-chair of the SFDSA Housing Committee. How are you?
Good. Doing great. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the West Coast Trap.
Yeah.
Today, we're going to be talking about a little thing called housing. You all know it. Many of you live in
You know what? I'm a big fan of housing. Also, love urban development. I think they go together really well.
Going spectacularly.
Some of you might have heard this, but there's something of a housing crunch in San Francisco.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I don't know if you've heard about this, but it is the most expensive place in the United States to live. So
hachi machi.
Yeah, it's pretty bad here. I think we've officially become the poster child of housing crisis.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great. Generated a lot of work for New York Times and Vox reporters. So I'm really glad that we could contribute there.
Oh, yeah. Even in Brooklyn, we are laughing at you from our unheated, rat-infested railroad apartments.
Yeah.
I just love the new American city where you have to make $750,000 a year to secure what would be like an acceptable middle class living anywhere else in America.
Well, that's our middle class now. You know, I think someone did a poll of some sort or something saying that a bunch of Silicon Valley people who are making like $400,000, $500,000 a year consider themselves the middle class now. They're like, you know, the middle class is really struggling.
So what's the recent history in San Francisco? How did it get here? How did it go from the hippie gay place that conservatives hated in the 60s and 70s to the tech hippie gay place that conservatives hate today?
Well, I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. One, yeah, like I think when people think of San Francisco's housing crisis, it is definitely exacerbated by the tech booms 1 and 2, right? We obviously are living through or adjacent to the most massive accumulation of wealth in human history. Right now in California alone, there's 125 billionaires. They have $500 billion between them. But
where do they live? Can we post the addresses in the... Description for this episode.
Mark Zuckerberg has his like sort of a fortress of solitude or whatever he built actually right near Dolores Park, which is a really popular tourist destination and also kind of like the hotbed of gentrification in the middle of the city. So some of them around here, a bunch of them live. So we're in Haight-Ashbury right now. A bunch of them live probably past some of them around here, but also like Pack Heights is Pacific Heights is a big neighborhood. And it's kind of used to be kind of old money. Like there's like Gettys there and stuff. But now it's kind of, you know, the Gettys are living next door to like, you know, the Farm Bill guy and all of that stuff. But that's not, I'm not lying about that.
Where'd you make your money? Sure, agriculture? I went long on pork bellies. Digital pork bellies.
The Candy Crush guy and the Farmville guy are like the J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, yep. The New Age.
Yeah. Yep.
The Daniel Plainview of Zynga Games. There's an ocean of content under our feet.
I abandoned my notifications.
Well, I was really waiting for the first, like, Juicero IPO based like mansion purchase. And I'm really, really upset that that fell through. So I'm glad that they're on the raw water kick now. Maybe that'll go somewhere. So
I wonder if like people here are like rappers and they're just always bragging about like their last failed venture. And they're like, bro, I haven't even spent my Juicero money. I'm on to the next stupid thing, a swing set for adults. So, that isn't a Sabian.
So all the tech people who work and they made their wealth in the south end of the Bay, like San Jose, Palo Alto, Cupertino, places like that, they go out and they buy houses in San Francisco proper.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, obviously, too, there's like tech workers here. They're building a lot of new construction in South Market called Soma. It's a neighborhood. There's a lot of office buildings there. So, for example, there's a new one that just got built, 181 Fremont. It's not even done, but Facebook already bought all of it so they can have a headquarters in San Francisco. So it's not finished. But one of the things that I wanted to kind of bring up, too, is like this kind of struggle between like real estate capital having a stranglehold on our political establishment and, you know, sort of a radical left tenant driven movement has actually been there long before the tech boom. And like those are the kind of battle lines that we're still fighting on today.
If you are a normal and you move to San Francisco from anywhere in the country, chances are you're not moving to San Francisco proper, right? You're going to Oakland.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, a lot of people want to live in San Francisco and in Oakland, right? Part of the whole phenomenon of what we saw is like creative class development. I mean, you guys live in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah,
people want to move places that are
if you want to move to the New York City area, you can't move to Manhattan anywhere below like 170th Street, basically, unless you had a very high income.
Yeah.
But it's a grim new future where, you know, everyone moves to the big city to make it, and by make it they mean like do exposure DJ sets.
Well, did you see that one of the tech solutions to this crisis, the disruptive tech solution, is to reinvent Soviet-era cooperative apartments? Did you see this? There's an article about how there's a new development where you spend like $2,500 a month to live in a dorm.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, yes. It looks like Warren's, basically.
Yeah, and they're communalizing it, but in this like rapacious capitalist framework.
They're also building it in one of San Francisco's poorest neighborhoods. It's a historically immigrant neighborhood, a historically black neighborhood. It is where most of the low income subsidized housing in the city is. So it is kind of funny that they're doing it there. But yeah, there was also I forget which tech company it was now. I wish I remembered. It was Google or Facebook or one of the big ones in kind of like the peninsula. But they wanted to they're starting to build worker housing on campus.
They're building company towns.
Company towns are back, baby.
We talked about
this. It's feudalism. You reinvented feudalism.
It's feudalism, but what with the infantilizing nature,
right?
That's part of tech culture.
It's baby feudalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Mama's little baby. Who's a good little serf?
Right.
Who's a good little parents could do to serve.
You have a fucking company town and company store and company script, but also in the company store you can't buy scissors that aren't childproof. You know, you get everything as nice little bright pastel colors. Ooh, you learn, treat.
So we also riffed on this in the live show because it's funny, they're building these company towns, and then I saw in an article by Sarah Jones that just one line in it that Facebook and Google employ Pinkertons, the literal Pinkerton detective agency. And so they're going to have company towns with Pinkerton agents roaming around monitoring your conversations,
making sure someone doesn't snitch.
And we're 6 months out from company script from Zuckbucks.
Oh man, I love getting plugged with a 38 by a Scots Irish psychopath because I said install Linux problem solved on company grounds.
This is all very real. For the record, full disclosure, I used to work in tech, and when I moved to like working in while I was like organizing on the side, and then when I finally moved to tenants' rights work full time, I literally had to like relearn how to be a person in some ways. Like I'm like, oh, I have to go outside and like purchase my lunch. Like I just didn't. What? Yeah. Because you know, there's a whole thing like you get your lunch so that you don't leave the office. Yeah. Yeah.
We went to
that's
the
real.
Twitch headquarters and it was just a treat bonanza. They got these kids in there like hamsters sitting in those offices probably 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
But then they have a constant stream of treats and snacks.
Yep.
So it's just like a big sleepover.
And they have they
instead
have,
of them ringing you for surplus value like they, a fucking jizz rag.
They have designated gaming areas. So yep. You all of your metabolic needs are taken care of.
You don't need to wait a minute, why go home and blow off steam and then go to sleep when you can work and then play some video games and then take a nap and then work again and then eat some fucking snacks. They had every goddamn snack on earth in that place.
It's actually gotten so bad. I saw an article where it's people were saying it's SF's restaurant industry is suffering because unless you're like going super high end, like some Michelin star shit, most of the chefs are being hired away by tech companies.
Ah, that's fuck. All.
Yeah.
Just
real.
Recreating the feudal economy. All of the artisans and craftsmen are going to revolve around the Lord, and the only proximity to him will give you access to their bounty. And the rest, and we're all behind the gates of these fucking gated business communities that might as well be the fucking drawbridge of a goddamn castle keep.
Sorry, I got to jump in here because yesterday we were walking around Golden Gate Park. Gorgeous, by the way.
Gorgeous park. Fuck you, Central Park. You're dog shit.
Central Park.
Absolute trash.
Pile of dung, in my opinion.
We need to get, when we get back, we are going through the Central Park with a monster truck.
Going there, Gravedigger.
Just rolling it over. The animals at Central Park Zoo have 2 minutes to evacuate or else they will become victims to the new regime.
Yeah. I mean, if you walk from end to end, from one end of Central Park to the other, your reward at the end of it is a fucking tortured horse being strapped to a wagon
so a
some awful
cart.
Fucking wheezing rubes can gawk at while this animal dies. Like the Turin horse. Here, you get to the end of Golden Gate Park. It's the fucking Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
It is a gorgeous volcanic beach.
That was incredible. But right before you get to the ocean, they even have an old style windmill out of a Bruegel painting.
Oh my God.
So we finally got there yesterday and we get there and we're sitting in front of this beautiful windmill and Matt starts going, folks, the mills, we're bringing them back. You're not going to believe it. They're going to be mills in the glen, mills in the valley. We're going to have so much wheat and flour.
Folks, the journeymen, the artisans, the masters, the apprentices, they're all working, folks.
Folks, they're sending us too many apprentices. Not enough masters.
We need more masters. Folks, we need masters, okay? If we want this mill to really work, we want to make the mill great again. We got to have enough masters. Too many apprentices. Get out of here.
I was laughing about Charles the Accursed the other day. And you know how he was betrothed to someone, married to someone, and she like died after like 20 years of marriage?
She died after she saw his penis.
Yeah, too big. Just too beautiful. Perfect dick. They call me Mr. Too Damn Perfect Dick. But anyway, his wife died, and he was like, they're like, how do you feel, Charles? And he goes, oh, that lady was nice. And that is such a Trump thing. Like, when they brought Trump to the Holocaust Museum, and he was like, ooh, not good.
Yeah, that's bad. Bad news, folks.
Yeah.
I have to ask, wait, real quick, did you guys see the bison? Do you know how the bison got there? It was a gift from Dianne Feinstein's husband, I believe, to her. And then he just was like, happy birthday or whatever, like happy anniversary. Here's a bunch of bison.
Oh, my God.
That's real.
So that's why the bison had a Confederate flag on it.
Yes, yes. That's why.
That is so fucking imperially decadent because isn't Feinstein's husband a fucking contractor with state and government contracts? Isn't that right?
Something like that.
Am I right about that?
Very wealthy man.
Well, it's funny. There's like a type of, it predates Lean In, but there's a type of like Californian Democratic female legislator like Jane Harman
who's just like the shittiest middle of the road, like NatSec Dem. And then you look them up and then it's like, oh yeah, their husband is like Eric Prince's dad. They just have all these contracts with the government.
That's actually a great segue into like kind of like a little bit of the history here, because Dianne Feinstein, as you know, was mayor of San Francisco.
Yep.
So you know, SF went through a lot of the same urban phenomena that other people went through. You know, the Fillmore was a historically black community that was raised through urban renewal. One of the most famous incidents in San Francisco housing history was the International Hotel strike, where, you know, that part of downtown, which is just all office buildings now, used to be, you know, a Southeast Asian, Filipino, et cetera, like stronghold. They lived in this place called the International Hotel, and they decided to just demolish it, some developer, without even knowing what they were going to put there. And, you know, it was one of the longest strikes in history. Like, the people stayed in the building. It was a really revolutionary, really radical moment. And Dianne Feinstein was the one who was like, yeah, you know, bring those bulldozers in. And another, a couple other things that she did was, you know, that political establishment opposed rent controls. They opposed vacancy controls. So vacancy control is like, if you live in a rent control place, you have to, and then, you know, the landlord kicks you out, you can raise that back to market rate. That's because of Dianne Feinstein.
Jesus.
She tried as hard as she was real estate funded, just like our politicians are now. And the only reason that we have rent control of any kind in San Francisco really is because there was a really infamous landlord who just kind of overreached by, I guess he owned a ton of properties, and he's known as the father of rent control because he just overreacted so fucking hard.
And there's no new rent control, right, because of state law?
Yeah, there's a law called Costa-Hawkins, which is a big focus for California statewide DSA chapters and just the tenants' rights movement in general.
Shame on you, Bob Costas.
Stephen Hawkins.
Stephen Hawkins.
Damn it, same joke. But
what an awful legacy by the man.
We had enough of a sort of people-powered movement, and it was really interesting. The tenant movement back then, the radical tenant movement, was gay and lesbian activists, queer activists, tenant activists, labor unions, the Catholic Archdiocese, interesting enough, and involved in the tenants' rights movement in San Francisco back then, believe it or not, Jonestown.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes. They were a reliable block of door knockers that the Democratic machine in San Francisco used. And Feinstein courted him. Jerry Brown courted him.
Yeah, they courted him.
They gave him a plum job as on the Equal Rights Commission and then the Housing Commission.
They played both sides of the housing.
Yeah, they were a big progressive interest group. That
is really disappointing to find out that Jim Jones worked with the Democratic Party. I really admired him before.
I thought he was a Soviet agent.
Yeah, believe it or not, so the tenants' rights movement SF was not founded by Jim Jones or any of those people.
Yes.
They were just kind of hanging
around. You stipulate
that. Yeah, yeah.
But he was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wore boss outfits and he had neat glasses and he dyed his hair black, which is boss. Yeah.
It's so cool to have soy sauce colored hair.
Can you imagine the logistical feat of hauling 1,500 senior citizens into the Guyanese wilderness?
Oh my!
Living there for a year. That's amazing.
We can't get my grandmother to like a dinner party that's 30 miles from her when we like call a cab for her.
It's like when you have a wedding with too many old people in the family, you have to have it at the nursing home.
Yeah, it's
because the logistics involved in getting them all to the same place are too overpowering.
Can you try to get one of your grandparents? Just pull them aside and be like, could you say something that's like not racist at this dinner? Now imagine like, hey, we're going to move to Guyana for a year and you're going to die there. Oh, okay.
By the way, the Jonestown massacre was bad. It was tragic and it was a bad thing. And just because we're joking about it doesn't mean that we think the people dying had it coming or anything like that.
Yeah, I just want to say on the behalf of the DSASF Housing Committee, we do not endorse the Jonestown Massacre.
I would like to say as a member of the Democratic Party, I do endorse the Jonestown Massacre. I'm a super delegate. So if you have a problem with me endorsing, I endorse all massacres in history. If you have a problem with that, call my boss, Tom Perez.
Well, anyway, I guess getting back to it. So, yeah, like San Francisco's real estate establishment has always been around. They've always had access to the levers of power. They've been checked by mass movements for tenant power, which is what's great about SF's history of radicalism. That today is different. You know, there's two really big phenomena that San Francisco has been hit with, obviously a tech boom, two tech booms, which I think we all know about, goes without saying. But also there's been this phenomenon in SF that the tech boom's kind of amplified, but it's happening in all American cities, which is, you know, sort of the creative class redevelopment. And that's named after this guy, Richard Florida, who wrote Rise of the Creative Class and was just like, yeah, when we bring in, you know, the wine bar laundromats, and that's a real,
Richard Florida.
That's real.
That's Duncan Idaho's brother.
riff of the day, special tour riff of the day. San Francisco housing credit goes to Matthew Chrisman. Yeah.
I also get a small satchel of the spice melange.
So yeah, this phenomenon of creative class redevelopment, which still hasn't really, you know, it's you see all these cities competing for Amazon and stuff, which, yeah, by the way, when Amazon said no to San Francisco, I was like, thank fucking
all God. The cities are competing for creatives like me.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that when I see people write about the creative economy and I'm like, what a bunch of jagoffs. And I'm like, oh, that's literally me. Yeah. It's like, oh, they want me to come to their city to order Grubhub and scream God's plan into my microphone because I stay inside 78 hours a week. That's good. That's the economy now. That fucking rocks. What a stupid country. I can't wait till this country collapses.
By the way, mayors, Jabbo Jabbo's is soliciting offers for our new plant, yeah, our new content factory. Show us what you got.
Now, we've heard criticism from the NIMBYs who say that, you know, your content farm is just a McDonald's playpen, but we're choosing not to entertain the haters. We're trying to heal these cities. We've taken bids from Zagreb, Croatia.
Awesome.
Donetsk, Ukraine, the Donetsk, yes, People's Republic, Ukraine.
Of course. Yeah,
and of course, Sana'a, Yemen.
Yes, and Peter Thiel's undisclosed freedom barge in the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's moving to LA, by the way. He's over SF.
Oh, he's like one of those guys who gets a tweet with like 100 retweets and he's like, oh, I think I could be a screenwriter. He's going to move to LA. He's going to be an LA fail guy. No, I know. He's starting at the EV Network. Someone told me about it on the
website. Yeah. He's basically made the decision that if he really wants to change things, he should do it at the level of culture, no longer investment.
Peter Thiel left San Francisco this year. J.D. Vance left San Francisco. What are we going to do?
We have a city now. J.D. Vance.
I know. He went back to the heartland. He's actually, well, he's from Ohio. I'm from Pittsburgh.
He is.
But he's currently, I'm sure, wrecking my home area.
He was flirting with running for governor.
Senate.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it's looking murky right now if he's going to actually.
No, he's not going to do it. He said no.
Yeah.
So he's just going to keep cranking out horseshit content until he inevitably gets a New York Times op-ed column.
He's taking other San Francisco VCs on a tour of Rust Belt cities. That was in the New York Times.
Can it end like Deliverance, please?
Just these assholes just going, oh man, there's so much human potential here. There's so much human power that we could mine.
That's literally what they said. You're quoting the article.
Some knowledge and innovation starter into the flower of the common people here. We could have coding farms from here to the edge of that holler.
I met this very inspiring young man whose name is Jerry Duncan. He's stolen everybody's headphones in town. He has an entrepreneurial spirit.
He was like, that's, you guys literally just stated exactly all of the quotes from the VC people in that article. They were like, it's just so refreshing. It's like everyone in San Francisco just wants to talk about their startup ideas. Like, have you gone outside and met any people? Like,
they can't even like meet people here. They have to go on a special safari.
Yeah, they had to go to the Rust Belt. Like, go to a community of color, for fuck's sake. There's a bunch of them here, although not for long if they have their way, but
No, they have to go to the Rust Belt because when they say white working class, they just immediately picture like guys, white guys in overalls. They just don't think anyone, like, if you're black, you're not working class.
No, you know what it is? You know what it is?
They have to go on a tour with Hallie Joe Assmunch. That's what J.D. Vance looks like. He looks like Hallie Joe Osment. Look it up. Second place riff of the day goes to me.
People keep saying I look like Hallie Joe Osment.
Ouch.
I should stop.
No, but the reason that they fetishize white working class poverty like that is because those poor people aren't the people who fetch their shit,
make their macchiatos,
and drive their Ubers, and actually supply them with labor in their urban lifestyles. Those people are people of color, and those relationships are very fraught with them. They don't really rather not think about it, so they displace all of their class anxiety about having to be cheek to jowl with people who have much less than them by displacing it onto this mythical soot-covered coal miner who they'll never meet and never have any interaction with.
They'll only see them behind like the Pope glass on the truck that J.D. Vance is driving.
His Pope mobile.
Yeah,
they'll kind of say shit like, as another thing I saw in the newspaper for some planning academic or some stuff. It's like, well, SF just isn't, you know, producing the people for these jobs. So, you know, we'll just have to keep importing them from elsewhere, which is a nice way of saying like tech companies don't hire black or brown people. Like,
we tried developing the talent here, but they just kept turning up black.
It turns out that there's just something about a person who is from a country that has a much lower standard of living and has left their family behind and has no connections to this country. There's just something about those workers. They really just, they perform really well. It's like they have
an
extra motivation. They get it.
That is the liberal immigration line, because it's the same thing with like the most obnoxious Remainers with Brexit, where it's like at a certain point you can tell they're sort of masking their demand for visa guest workers that they can pay like 70 to 30% of the minimum wage with like, no, this is our, you know, this is our strength. And it's like, okay, that's, you just want a pool of cheap labor. You wouldn't grant them full rights. You would never do that. You would never grant them full labor protections.
Yeah. And that's why also like all of these tech billionaires and millionaires are like, oh my God, there looks like there's some problems here. So, you know, they're now jumping in and trying to fix it in the naturally most ass backwards way possible.
Yeah. You think about all that software you like, how they patch it and they're like, oh, whoops, we had a little back hole where we sent your SSN, the SSN that will be assigned to your children. We sent it to South Sudan. Our bad. We patched it. Imagine that approach taken to the rest of the country, patching America. America v. 0.832.
Let's get back to housing. So what else is going on? What's in the news?
What's in the news? Besides just the general acceleration of displacement, I mean, I've told some fun stories about tech feudalism and all of the fun effects that it's having here. We're obviously in the middle of an unprecedented homelessness crisis. Yes. So the UN special rapporteur on housing came here and basically said, like, this is like Mumbai. Or, yeah, she did. Like, she literally said San Francisco is like Mumbai, which as a someone of Indian descent, I can appreciate.
So, no, San Francisco, it's a very liberal place, obviously. I assume all the supervisors are good Democrats, good progs.
Yes, every single one of them.
Every single one of them. So why don't they just do the good things that Democrats promise to do?
Yeah, I mean, you have like a sort of a schism. So there is the progressives and the moderates. They're all Democrats. Everyone's Democrats. Everyone's sort of kowtowing towards like, yeah, we believe in equality and justice and all of that stuff, which especially in the Trump era, they've kind of used to score points, right? Because we're compared to the rest of the country, everyone thinks this is like a progressive utopia. But really, there's two factions. There's progressives, there's moderates. Moderates are way more of kind of your standard like Chamber of Commerce, Realtors Association. And that's where a lot of the tech money has gone. So tech billionaires, including the biggest, I think, individual donor to political campaigns is an angel investor in Airbnb and several other companies. His name is Ron Conway. You probably might hear his name a lot when people are drunk and complaining about how this city's going to shit. Tech billionaires have now taken an outsized role in those campaigns, primarily, actually entirely on behalf of that sort of moderate pro-business Chamber of Commerce faction, where literally they'll just be like, oh, it's Wednesday, let me dump like $200,000 into a race.
So we've talked about the impact of developers, the impact of tech monsters. I'm told there's a new faction that has emerged, a grassroots movement to solve of the housing crises in San Francisco.
These are the people who saw the problem and said, let's build our way out.
No more. I believe you were referring to some people who love to tweet at me called the Yes in My Backyard.
Yes, right? The YIMBYs.
Yeah. They are for yes into something in their backyards. I'm speaking my experiences only with California, But that is kind of, I think, where this sort of movement kind of germinated. And it's kind of become here this sort of classic centrist, like armchair technocratic solutionism. Mm-hmm. So it's mostly like, you know, it's kind of, they got called libertarians a lot, but it's very sort of centrist liberal in a sense. That's the left end of the tent. And then there, it's kind of infused with this Silicon Valley techno-libertarian streak of we're going to growth hack housing. It's got a sprinkle of liberal, like, you know, we know what's best for you, do-gooderism. But sometimes, especially online, it's articulated by some of the most fragile edgelords on
yes,
the planet.
So I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that San Francisco is patient zero for YIMBYism, which has since spread through many metropolitan areas. I know there's some in New York now, too. And these are people who have identified the problem as NIMBYism, the not-in-my-backyard types, who want to maintain their precious, quaint neighborhoods with, you know, height limits on buildings and things like that. And that's why we don't have any progress here. We have to actually rip shit up and
if you
just build.
Let us build more. People could fill all of those new units. How? What's so hard to understand about that?
Yeah, it's those NIMBYs, by the way, like they are, I will say, very real. I've been at hearings and heard them say all sorts of crazy stuff. A lot of racism sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they'll show up with power. Literal true story of this guy in Marin. They'll show up with PowerPoint slideshows of like MS-13 people. Stuff like that.
Those guys get around, man.
So they're real, but they're
just like old school reactionaries. They're old school, blue blood types who don't want poor people in the neighborhood. They want to lose their view or whatever.
Yeah, they've been around forever, and they're kind of like the beneficiaries of redlining. And redlining is a thing that you'll hear YIMBYs talk about a lot, which is redlining is super important. It was basically this imposition of exclusionary mortgage lending, exclusionary zoning.
Yes,
which is something that they're really, really big about. But basically, the housing discourse has become, if you're not a YIMBY, you're a NIMBY. And that's been fun for DSA because, you know, we've been doing the right thing by taking a fuck ton of heat from both of those sides, which I think means we're on the right track. But yeah, it's the way that they frame it is if you're not a YIMBY, if you don't buy our specific development paradigm where the market knows best, you're a NIMBY, you're
those
an obstructionist. The two genders. NIMBY and YIMBY. And, you know, I get a lot of this directed at me, certainly in DSA. But one of the things I wanted to highlight was a comrade just sent me this. And this is kind of, I think, indicative of their attitude. Here's something someone said. You know, this is a bill that they're pushing, related to a bill they're pushing. Anyone who's following this bill knows that most tenant groups and anti-displacement groups, communities of color, have come out in opposition to our bill. I appreciate their work, but these groups have utterly failed at their mission, and we're just not going to do it their way anymore.
Wow.
So,
take that, big minority community organizations. We're not living under your thumb anymore.
Those black and Latino tenants have just had it too good for too long.
Move aside. So YIMBYism, answer me this, Bleeding Heart. Why can't we just build our way out of it?
Yeah, well, how do I put this? You know, the mode of production for housing, especially when you have a rabid land market in high demand areas like New York and Brooklyn, where you guys live, and San Francisco,
where I live,
doesn't necessarily, you know, asset markets and asset price speculation and human need kind of just don't really get along that well. And then you start to see things like vacancies. You start to see things like overbuilding at the top end of the market, which is happening across American cities. It's not just San Francisco or New York or like it's happening across American cities. There's studies, you know, Harvard just came out with their housing survey and they're like, developers, landowners, et cetera, are incentivized to sell and build land at the very top end of the market. And that's how we ended up with our fail sons in the White House, by the way. That's a good example of some developer and landowner behavior.
You're telling me if we gave Jared Kushner a carte blanche to build a 100-story skyscraper and plop it in the middle of Haight-Ashbury, that would not solve homelessness?
Do you think the Williamsburg waterfront has solved homelessness?
I would say no.
Yes.
Yeah, but those are great places to store all of those Bravo reality show contestants. Every one of those shows, they just buy an entire floor of one of those undersold condos and have them all be just go, I'm not here to make friends while I make this fucking bruschetta.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, what you were telling me about when we were talking about this the other night is like the Yimbys are all like liberals in good stead, and they're all very progressive, and they all think of themselves as like, you know, liberal and anti-racist, and they hate poverty and like, you know, systemic disenfranchisement and poverty of African Americans in this country. But they've convinced themselves that that this development is what is going to finally crack the aching and systemic problem of like the legacy of redlining in housing and cities.
Exactly. So they
and like, so like what by their calculus, like how will that be achieved if we let real estate developers do whatever they want?
It's pretty simple. You know, even what if they built a luxury housing tower? Eventually those prices will go down. They won't leave it vacant or anything.
Yeah, it's not
when it becomes like J.G. Ballard's high rise, the rents will slowly creep back down.
That's a good point, because it's not like you build all of this luxury housing and absentee billionaires just buy it up because it's a great way to store your wealth. That's never happened in a major metropolitan
area. Not at all. Not like New York or London. There aren't entire neighborhoods that are completely empty and every single unit is a speculative asset for the fail son of some Russian oligarch.
Also, what's extra ironic is, so we have something in SF called the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project. They're pretty cool. My co-chair is a member of them. They've done some calculations because, you know, there's obviously with financialized real estate capital being internationally leveraged, being this sort of phenomenon that you can't track, it's securitized, it's sliced and diced into derivatives and all of that stuff. At the same time, you also still see this phenomenon of some of the buyers of vacant units in San Francisco are actually the NIMBYs that they're complaining about who are living outside of SF and sort of places like Marin County and et cetera. It's literally just a human centipede of investment, like just feeding itself.
It is a dialectic. It is a negative dialectic.
So these are, I mean, you say these are good liberal people, but I when I hear about YIMBYs online, I also see a lot of like ANCAP type cranks.
Yes.
Like just totally weird asocial. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Justine Tunney became a YIMBY.
Yes, she did. There is a strong ANCAP streak, and I think it comes from that sort of Silicon Valley techno-libertarianism to an extent. But it's also, I mean, they're the founder of the movement. Used to kind of hang out in some libertarian circles, although she disputes that now because she's running for office. But one of the things that the quotes that really got out there about her, one of her most famous or infamous quotes, rather, if you will, is gentrification is the revaluation of black land to its correct price.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the general idea is, you know, okay, so the dichotomy that they're trying to present is you have to choose between the NIMBYs, the petty bourgeois homeowners who are betting on real estate.
Jets and sharks, baby.
Yeah, jets and sharks, NIMBY. Petty bourgeois homeowners in one corner betting on real estate to access capital, and then the YIMBYs, the big bourgeois developers who are reinvesting their surpluses. But you got to be one. You got to choose one.
Yeah, if you...
Team NIMBY, by the way.
Yeah, that's what
I got an idea. It's a crazy idea. How about we decommodify housing?
I know, right? Then they'll tell you what they tell me all the time, which is, but first, the revolution. That's a...
I know, but it's just so frustrating because ground rent is pure parasitism.
Yes.
It is the pure... It can't even be justified on capitalist grounds. You're not doing anything. You're not contributing. You're literally just absorbing land value fluctuations that are due to investments that have nothing to do with you. You're a pure parasite. You are a fat dick.
Been screaming this into the void for a couple of years now. But that's exactly it, too. But the way that you can kind of tell is, like, because there is that centrist liberal sort of mindset, too, like, we're good San Franciscans, we believe in equality and tolerance, et cetera, you'll hear people saying, well, yeah, I would support social housing or public housing if you have, a plan for it. I do support rent control in theory. Or I would like some rent control, you know, it's not always bad. It's a price distortion, et cetera. You know, a vacancy tax like that probably might be good, you know, but it's always, you know, we would support this in theory, but then, you know, California, like I mentioned before, has this rich history of tenants' rights organizations, groups and communities of color, not just in SF, but also in LA has been really like with groups like Defend Boyle Heights. You are really seeing this new renewed radicalism from young people and communities of color, and that just gets totally wiped aside. It's like we can't question development capital fundamentally there's an unwillingness to challenge its logic.
Right. And the housing has to be dictated by the market. That's the only proper way to organize urban areas.
Yeah, yeah. And the, you know, the market will sort most of this out. Basically, the idea is like maybe some poor people at the bottom, which, I mean, I guess you haven't been paying attention to income inequality or the fact that Blacks and Latinos are not going to have any wealth in the next 20 or 30 years. That was from Forbes, by the way. But like, I guess you're not paying attention to the hell world that's around us where you're thinking the market will take care of most of this. We'll build subsidized housing for the poor. But
all you people freaking out about this and thinking this is a horrible future, you must be the weirdos who watch the Dread movies and think this looks awful. Because Mega City 1 in either the Stallone or the Keith Urban version looks really cool. Those giant fucking automated towers... They've got all your conveniences there. There's amazing drugs that make time slow down. It looks fantastic.
I love learning how to code when I'm 12. So in the next 20 years of my life, I can make Final Fantasy VII a reality. I love taking my Buster Sword to work.
Well, what were you guys talking about? The show Powder Mountain.
Yeah. It's so Powder good to Mountain. See you, brother. How are you living?
Yes.
So the other thing about Yimmy is like just them. There, it's a small group of people, but I guess it's like kind of steadily getting larger.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, louder and dumber.
Very online.
And there's this weird attempt to make Yimbyism seem cool.
Yes.
And there are these Yimby meme groups on Facebook. One is called Yimby Memes for Developer Shill Teams. And here's one of those.
I didn't even know about that one.
Mr. Rogers putting his shoes on, and he goes, "Hello, friends. I'm putting my shoes on to go down to City Hall because I received a notice in the mail about a zone change in the neighborhood, and I want to say yes in my backyard."
It's like they saw like those, you know, DSA, the dankest of the dank memes pages, and we're like, how can we make this wordier and
because the 2016 election gave birth to social, I would call them broadly social democrat memes, taking memes out of the gutter of the nihilistic churn of the internet and turning it into a vehicle for broad social democracy thanks to the Bernie campaign, right? And those are like, yeah, dank meme stash and all that shit. And that has arisen sort of a consciousness among neoliberals of themselves as a class, and then that gives them the corresponding desire to have their own version of those memes.
Some of them put them in their Twitter handles,
yes,
too.
So you've got now our neoliberalism on Reddit, and you have these efforts to create memes for centrists.
It's like, I think Peter Gowan from the People's Policy Project made this joke, so I got to attribute it to him, but he was like, who are all these people coming at me on Twitter with names like Deregulation Dennis and the Zoning Wig? Like,
it's a good sign, though, because a few years ago, these people, it wouldn't make sense to them to identify that way. No. They would say, I'm a liberal. What are you talking about? You know, I'm a progressive. That would be good enough for them. They wouldn't think that their specific ideology even had a name.
Right.
Now they have an understanding of it, and they're creating a culture around it, including memes. But that means that they have to defend it. It's not assumed, and it is so indefensible that their memes are weak and not, in fact, dank.
Give us the memes.
And that culture kind of is like, it's good. It's insulating in a way, because obviously, like, yeah, the good thing that they are doing is basically be like, hey, NIMBYs suck. But we're all saying that. Those people suck. Yeah, if a guy puts MS-13 in his PowerPoint presentation at the Planning Commission, everything I've said is real, including the wine laundromat, by the way. But, you know, once you kind of get beyond that, that also insulates you from having to do things like organize in communities of color.
Yeah.
Like figure out that maybe most of the housing that we're advocating for building isn't going to meet those communities, or that it's going to indirectly displace them. And I think one good thing that they kept talking about, or one of their favorite things to say, although they say less now, is Obama is a YIMBY. And I think that's really relevant. Because I heard from some housing activists in Chicago, where he's building his presidential library, that, you know,
in my neighborhood.
There you go. And there, people there, activists there, are doing what Obama, what he used to do. They're lobbying for a community benefits agreement. They're saying, you're going to build this center here. There's going to be rising property values. People are going to be evicted. We want a property tax freeze for the small businesses like bodegas and stuff, so they don't get kicked out for like kombucha breweries. And like, we want some like community investments so that we can help stabilize people in lower income housing, et cetera, et cetera. And Obama was like, nah, like, fuck it. Like, he's just like, no, it'll, you know what? Like, the jobs that the center is creating are going to be fine. Like, if your rents go up, then that'll take care of it. It'll trickle down to you. And he literally said that, like, this last week.
Wow.
Yep. And immediately, some local landlord who's also a reverend, I believe, and he's he was also opposing on behalf of Obama. He sided with Obama and said, opposing, let's oppose this community benefits agreement. You know, it's going to be great. He raised the rent immediately on his tenants by like something like $200 overall. Like, that's perfect. When they say Obama is the enemy, like, that's what happens when you just say extracting concessions from capital is bad. Negotiating mm-hmm. with developers is bad because we need to expedite housing at all costs.
Hyde Park, actually, it's like an interesting case study in all this because, yeah, I grew up there and it was always like an extremely well stratified place because it's the little mini green zone on the south side of Chicago because of the University of Chicago being there. You know, you can't have any of the rampant crime surrounding the Milton Friedman Center for Torturing the Poor, or the Augusta Pinochet Center for Democracy that they have at UChicago. But it was always like an extremely rich place, but there were pockets of like these black owned businesses, these sort of some worker cooperatives and some things that were like actually interesting, actually had like their own identity. Like I've talked about Bon Santé, the sort of Hotep Light health food store. And there was like this very interesting like neighborhood character that existed in between the pockets of NPR listener jerk offs. Like my family. And, but it was the thinking was always like, well, you know, why would you even gentrify this place? You're in a green zone in like one of the richest neighborhoods in Chicago, surrounded by some of the poorest, most dangerous parts. Then they somehow did it. They did it. They kicked out like pretty much every black owned business that had like any type of like neighborhood characteristic that was interesting, that made the place more than just a fucking Rhodesia for assistant professors. and we had this on 53rd.
God damn.
And on 53rd Street, it was that 53rd Street was four blocks from where I grew up. And it was where all, say, like the plurality of the interesting things were. And they tore everything down and they put up this disgusting glass steel monstrosity so they could have like an Akira shoe store, or they could have a fucking Chipotle, they could have another fucking Starbucks. The Chicago worked together with the developers to just redline everything and streamline everything and efficiently push out everything that wasn't just owned by people like the UChicago higher administration. And now, yeah, I guess they're doing the coup de grace. The body's on the ground and they want to put two in the head. Yeah, and Obama's helping them.
That's the phenomenon that's just fundamentally like not there, which is that the same neighborhoods, the exact same neighborhoods in San Francisco, in Chicago, in New York, et cetera, the same neighborhoods that were redlined, those communities of color, those black communities, Latino communities, Asian communities, et cetera, they are now, what's reversed is that white people didn't want to live there before. They all want to live there now.
That's exactly what happened to Bushwick. Bushwick was a working class white Catholic neighborhood in the post-war era, and redlining was deemed unconstitutional.
Right.
And so realtors did a different tack, and they did block busting.
Yeah.
So they moved black people in, or, you know, one of the famous tactics is paying a black woman to push a stroller around, things like that, to scare these white people into moving to suburbs, which they did. Then they basically got subprime mortgages, and then, well, first they bought out these houses from the white people who moved out at fire sale prices. Then they sold them to people of color with subprime mortgages. That was also a big scandal in the 70s. It was the FHA scandal, which hit Bushwick, Newark, and all those places. That led to the arson crisis in New York, where you're underwater, so just burn the place down. And at one point at Bushwick was 1 out of 10 buildings rubble.
And, ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning.
That was destroyed, and the neighborhood only really started to come back when Ed Koch kept his campaign promise to actually build public housing there, like nice livable public housing there. And eventually it led to today, where it's, you know, rapidly being gentrified.
Right, right. And that's the thing. It's that those neighborhoods, I think someone in, I forget who, called it blue lining, which I thought was really a good term, but it's basically the idea that those same areas that were redlined are now subject to this like deluge, this flood of investment that they have no control over. And so the answer to this from the market urbanist or the YIMBY perspective is, well, we just, because of these NIMBY guys who aren't letting us build there, and because of them, we got to get rid of control for everybody. So that means that these low-income communities, you don't get to have a say over what happens to you anymore. Not even anymore. They've never had a say over that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, forgive me if this seems a little too stereotypical, but it strikes me that a lot of these YIMBYs are poorly socialized individuals.
What gives you that idea? Sort of see things in a, a abstracted fashion. Sort of an emotional distance.
Well, I get this vibe that they conceive of housing as something that's sort of siloed off from everything else, and they can't really conceive of a community as an organic, you know, structure that functions.
Right, right.
And so they believe like, homelessness or segregation to upzone. Yeah, and then people will move in, the market will take care of those problems. Because a house is just a place where you sleep, right?
Right, right.
Before you go to your tech job.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that what's the premise of all this market-friendly stuff is that somehow people who are being left behind monetarily, people who have less by definition, are going to have access to housing that is going to be put on a market for a market price. How will they ever work? How will they ever be able to meet those criterion? Because it's always going to be moving towards the highest price point. That's what the market does.
And
the contradiction between the exchange and use value of property is one of the fundamental contradictions of capitalism. And using more capitalism to fix the fucking problem is just throwing gasoline on the fire.
And it's fine if, you know, the character of the neighborhood fundamentally changes and minority-owned businesses shutter because I don't have to go to a bodega. I can go to a Whole Foods.
Well, that's what's
I don't happening. Have to go to a barbershop. I get my haircut from someone on Craigslist.
I don't have to go anywhere because everything comes to me on a fucking little drone buddy. Comes through my window and he fucking cuts my hair and gives me a taquito.
As well as some famous YIMBYs, I believe, include Noah Schachtman.
Noah Opinion. But I think the head YIMBY,
Noah Smith, right?
I think the grand poobah of YIMBY is one Matthew Iglesias.
Maddie, friend,
the rent is too damn high. One of the 15 fucking portfolios this fucking fraud in Mount Bonk has tried to grab for himself over the course of his career. I followed this fucking asshole from his fucking pupil stages, and I know this motherfucker, he came out the gate, he was going to be a NatSec guru for the new post 9/11 liberal interventionist Democratic Party. He wrote a book on that subject called Head in the Sand. That no one on earth bought, including Raphael Iglesias. And that didn't go. So then he was going to be, for a while there, the libertarian, nudgy deregulation guy. Housing.
Occupational licensing.
Right. He was going to be the sensible urbanist, the smart urbanist solutions, the market-based urbanist solutions to alleviate environmental and inequality problems in urban areas. That was his big idea. We're going to solve global warming and give everybody a home by using smart development. Then that's what he wrote, The Rent is Too Damn High. Then I think he went to fucking Slate and he was the macro econ guy. He was Mr. Fed. He was Mr. Quantitative fucking Easing. He's just this constant churn of fucking portfolios to fucking mask his fundamental airheadedness and lack of knowledge about any of these things. So before you can kind of catch on to the fact that he's basically a fraud, he's moved on to a new fucking fake area of expertise. I can't wait till he becomes a Ukraine scholar and starts talking about like the eternal character of the Magyar oppressor.
In his defense, they didn't
oppress Ukraine. Shut up.
In his defense, when Matt Iglesias gentrifies a neighborhood, he doesn't change the racial character because he wears the dreadlocks all the time.
Holy shit!
Damn, son, where'd you find this?
Maybe riff of the tour.
It might be riff of the tour.
Well, I mean, riff of the tour is up against one of the Steve Harveys I did. So.
And you know, another one is probably Clara Jeffrey, who actually she came on my radar with this totally boneheaded discussion of housing in Manhattan, and you know she's against rent control because it means landlords aren't going to do any upkeep to their building.
That famous upkeep that landlords love doing in Manhattan.
I was at like a Costa Hawkins rally, or rather Costa Hawkins repeal. So there was a bill to repeal Costa Hawkins, which is this law that limits rent control across California.
Good.
And what the landlords were saying there was not really about upkeep. They had signs that said, we don't take, you know, we don't make money off of drug revenues and welfare. Or, you know, one of them told me, accosted me and told me why, asked me why I was supporting rent control with DSA. And he said, some of my best friend's employees are black. That's how that conversation ended.
Charm offensive, baby. Exactly. Time to turn on that old Wiggum charm.
Yep, those are the landlords, Clara Jeffries lionizing the small business owners, if you will.
You know that, you know when you have diarrhea seeping through your walls and within 18 months someone gets back to you about scheduling an appointment at 5 a.m.? But say goodbye to that when rent control comes in.
Sorry, real quick about Clara Jeffrey. Did you see the thing earlier just this week where I believe it was Emily Nussbaum and Jeb Lund were going back and forth. We're going back and forth over the issue of, you know, whether we should not be cynical about whether the Parkland teens sort of appropriate for themselves Harry Potter or speak to
they're not
things.
Appropriating because that's literally who Harry Potter is for. You know, everyone was making fun of adults doing it, but she turned it into this issue.
Appropriating isn't the right word, but like whether we should be cynical or not about the, you know, the fact that they say that, oh, I'm inspired by Harry Potter to fight against the Voldemort NRA. I'm not quite sure. They were having a normal conversation about that. Clara butted in to complain that the same people who make fun of her woke, quote unquote, woke toddler tweets, where she's like, my son said, but mommy, Bernie Sanders isn't even a Democrat. You know, the same people that make fun of her for that are being like, hey, like, you know, take it easy on the Parkland kids. So Clara interjected herself in that conversation to complain that people like the Parkland kids, but not her asinine tweets about her child. That her child isn't as praised as the Parkland teens.
It's interesting that people like the Soviet dog who died from going to space, and not my dog.
Shandi, we're about out of time here, but YIMBY's bad. Big developers bad.
DSA good. No.
Yeah. What is good? What should be the takeaway? A lot of our listeners are in urban areas that face the exact same issues. And what do you think is a constructive thing that people should be doing in their communities?
What is good is the first thing that you can do is if you are near in an urban area, if you're near a tenants' rights organization, like if you just even have a few hours a day to become a tenant counselor, learn what these needs are. I mean, yeah, like I said, join DSA, but honestly, it's like, no, get on the ground, learn what gentrifying communities of color are going through. Mm-hmm. Volunteer at a tenants' rights organization if you only have a few minutes. Metro DC DSA, if you're in DSA, is putting together, like, they've had some awesome anti-eviction campaigns. Peg McLaughlin over there has been trying to put together something nationally, so hopefully we'll have some kind of toolkit there.
Even if some of our members are the ones gentrifying.
That is correct. Listeners. But, you know, that's the difference. That's the difference, is acknowledge your complicity in this larger system. Yes. And start to do something about it. If you don't take that step, that's how you're going to end up believing that the market is going to solve everything.
Right.
Because you don't talk to those
people. Yeah, because it strikes me that YIMBYs are just fundamentally people who are just gentrifiers but don't feel guilty about it and think like, oh, I'm actually doing a good thing because I'm engaging in the market.
Yes. Or I'm fixing this. You know, I read about redlining. It's bad. But like, you know, that's the thing. Like, they keep, now they have some power. They're writing bills on the state level and they are not consulting with any of these groups, any group, any tenant group, any community of color, and then they get, they're surprised when those groups are like, we don't want what you're giving us.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the right way forward. You need to listen to us and to listen to our needs. And also, if you're in San Francisco, one thing that DSA San Francisco has been working on a lot, we are working on a ballot measure right now. So New York has a means-tested version of this, but if this ballot measure passes in June, we will be the first city to have a universal right to eviction council. for anyone living in the city. Doesn't matter how much money you're making. Doesn't matter if you're documented or undocumented. Doesn't matter. Universal right to counsel. And we have 2 months to basically close the deal on this. So we've been pretty busy.
I just wanted to pop in with the banal and ultimately pretty bourgeois observation that all the new real estate-led development in these urban areas looks like total ass.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Terrible.
That is one among the many reasons that it should be stopped.
Bring back Gaudi.
Yeah.
I saw a Yimby meme the other day that was just, it was a picture of, you know, just like a street in San Francisco, you know, one of those inclined streets with the row houses, right?
Yeah.
You know, very iconic look. And that was the bad image. And the good image was that same block, but with two just cubic, hideous buildings
glass.
Going up to like 8 stories just plopped in the middle.
This city
there.
Looks like...
That was the good... That was the it was like a Drake meme, and like Drake was loving it.
This city, by the way, looks like a dollhouse that somebody blew up.
Talk yeah. about fucking bugs,
it's a
man.
Toy city.
Talk about fucking...
And it should continue looking like that
those
instead
are
of...
Those are literal
40-story glass.
Those are bug men. They crave the idea of living in a fucking hive.
Yeah, like...
They just... Their dream literally, of existence is just everyone being absorbed into some sort of, like, fucking nanobite goo.
You have more money...
reconstituted...
Yeah, you have more money than God, and you're like living in this box and like drinking like I don't know some kind of chemical sludge yeah, mixed with like you know non-fluoride water.
I gotta think. It's like it's the internet,
like,
man.
It's like fucking Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Switchel.
It's like they're doing goon dorm first year in the dorm. It's like, yeah, me and my friends, we all make $17 million a year. What is your lifestyle? Well, I've replaced all my meals with like a Muscle Milk that's shittier. I just keep my door open, my dorm room door open.
This is the first generation of people who come into money, vast sums of world-changing money, and were born in and around computers. They're trying to use the money to turn the world into the inside of a computer.
A lot of these luxury housing buildings are, in addition to being hideous, incredibly shoddily constructed. And I guarantee in about 20 years, they're just going to start falling apart all over Williamsburg.
Well, have you seen the Salesforce Tower? It's now the tallest building ever. It looks like a giant butt plug.
I think that maybe they think that if like they live inside of the computer, they'll get to meet Mia Khalifa. Which I'm on board.
I mean, that's
gentlemen.
Why Ready Player One, we're going to have a lot to talk about because it really does seem like the id of these people turned into a film.
Do you want me to order that ether off of Amazon?
Yes. Okay.
So, Shanti Singh, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
It's been an honor and a privilege.
And
to be in
Portland,
the
trap. Seattle, we'll see you soon.
Yes.
Both those shows are sold out, but if you don't pay money for a scalper that may or may not be an actual ticket, you're not a real fan. Unsubscribe.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye.